Ever wish you could write code that's practically immune to some of the trickiest bugs? You know, like what if your programming language just like guaranteed you'd never have a memory leak again?
That's a fascinating thought. And actually, it's not as far-fetched as it might sound. That's where this really intriguing world of substructural type systems comes in.
Okay, now you've piqued my curiosity. Substructural type systems. That sounds pretty intense.
It does sound a bit intimidating, yeah.
So today we're diving deep into this concept and how it all connects to something called a joint logic, all based on these two academic papers you sent over.
Yeah, so the core idea is actually pretty intuitive when you get down to it. Basically, we're going to challenge some of the usual assumptions about how we use like variables and data when we're programming. Think of it this way. In most languages, you can declare a variable, right? And you can use it once, you can use it a million times, you can even never use it at all. Substructural type systems basically say, hey, what if we enforce some stricter rules about this?
So instead of the wild west of variable usage, we get a bit of law and order.
Exactly. For example, you could have a system where a variable must be used exactly once and then it's gone. Poof. That's actually called an affine type system, and it's one of the ideas that's explored in that inferencepaper.pdf.
Well, that's interesting. I can already see how something like that could help prevent those pesky memory leaks. If the compiler knows a variable has to be used once and only once, it can make sure that you know that those resources are managed really cleanly. No more forgetting to deallocate memory.
You got it. You're spot on. Yeah. It's like having the compiler act as this incredibly meticulous auditor, making absolutely sure that every single resource is accounted for. And this kind of strictness, it isn't just about memory management either. It can actually lead to all sorts of compiler optimizations that can make your code way faster and way more efficient.
Now, the paper also mentions these things called modes, and they seem to be pretty key to how this whole system works.
Right, yeah. Think of modes as like these labels or these categories that we can assign to different resources, like our variables, to control exactly how they can be used. So some modes might enforce that single-use rule that we were just talking about, while others might allow unlimited use, and of course, there's this whole spectrum in between.
So it's not just like a binary switch of can I reuse this or not? It's more like we have this really nuanced system for defining exactly how resources can be used and reused within a program. And this is where a joint logic enters the picture.
Yeah, precisely. One of the things that makes a joint logic so powerful, and this is described in that EDGIN24.pdf paper, is that it can actually combine different substructural logics really gracefully. So imagine you want to reason about code with all these different modes interacting with each other. Instead of awkwardly forcing one logic into another, a joint logic provides these really elegant adjoint modalities that act like bridges between all these different modes of reasoning.
So if each mode is like a, I don't know, like a specialized lens for viewing your code. Oh, I like that.
A joint logic is the thing that lets you switch between all those different lenses seamlessly.
That's a great analogy. And the really, really cool part is that this framework, it can handle a surprisingly wide range of logics. So we're talking like linear logic, affine logic, strict logic, and even some of the more exotic ones like intuitionistic S4, which relates to commonads, and lax logic, which relates to monads.
Okay, I have to admit, you've dropped a couple terms there that are definitely pushing the limits of my programmer vocabulary. Commonads, monads. I've definitely heard them whispered in hushed tones in those like really advanced programming talks. Don't worry, I think we can loop back to those a bit later. But for now, it seems like we're already wading into some pretty deep waters here. How does a programmer actually use this adjoint logic thing without, needing a PhD in theoretical computer science?
That's actually a question that inferencepaper.tdf tackles head on. So imagine you had to like manually specify the mode for every single variable and every single function in your code.
It would be a nightmare.
Yeah, I can imagine that getting old pretty fast. It'd be like having to explain like every little detail of grammar to a friend who just wants to have a casual conversation.
Precisely. Precisely. And that's where this really cool idea of mode inference comes in. So this paper basically introduces an algorithm that can automatically figure out what the most permissive modes are for your program.
So it's like the compiler is saying, don't worry, I got this. You just focus on writing the code and I'll make sure that it, you know, adheres to all the rules of substructural logic.
Exactly. And what makes it even more impressive is that the mode inference that they describe in this paper, it's actually what we call decidable, even when you're dealing with like recursive types and functions, which can get really hairy.
Okay, I'm going to need a bit of a refresher. What exactly does decidable mean in this context?
Sure, yeah. So in the world of, you know, computer science and logic, decidable basically means that there is a guaranteed way for an algorithm to come up with a definite answer. Like it will give you an answer in a finite amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
And with some other forms of type inference, especially when you start throwing recursion into the mix, you can actually run into situations where the algorithm might just keep running forever trying to figure things out.
Oh, wow.
It gets really messy.
So with this mode inference, we have like a guarantee, like we're guaranteed a definitive answer no matter how complex the code might be.
Exactly.
That's a huge relief for us programmers out there. It means we can be confident that the compiler will actually be able to understand and analyze our code effectively and apply these, you know, powerful optimizations.
You got it. And what's really cool is that inferencepaper.pdf doesn't just describe this algorithm in some kind of like abstract way, you know.
Mm.
It actually walks through how it works with some really concrete examples and like notations and all that.
Okay, yeah. I'm all about concrete examples. Can we maybe dive into some of the, I don't know, the nitty-gritty details from the paper? Like, show me how this mode magic actually works in code.
Absolutely. So let's take a look at how they actually represent types with these modes. Mm. They use this notation that looks like this, NATM, and that basically translates to natural numbers at mode M.
Okay.
And then they have these things called shifts, which are represented by like up and down arrows with modes attached to them. And what these shifts do is they basically change the mode of a type within like a larger expression. So think of them like these little signposts that are guiding how we can actually move between all these different modes.
Okay, so it's like a mini language kind of within the type system itself.
Yeah.
Specifically designed to control all these mode changes. But how does the inference algorithm actually put all these different pieces together? Like, it can't read my mind, can it?
No mind reading required, I promise. So the paper explains how the inference process actually gathers what we call constraints on these mode variables as it goes through and analyzes your code. It's kind of like putting together a jigsaw puzzle, right? Where each piece of code, each little snippet, each function, each variable provides some clues about what all those modes have to be to keep everything consistent, to keep everything logically sound.
Okay, so do they give any specific examples of, you know, that constraint solving in action?
Yeah, they do. They use the classic like free map function as an example to illustrate this. So let's say, you know, a map, it applies a function to every element in a list. So the inference algorithm basically looks at how that function is being used within FiffMap.
Right.
So if that function is being applied to the same element multiple times, that actually creates what's called a contraction constraint on that element's mode, because it means that that element is being used more than once.
So if that element's mode was supposed to be like that use once mode,
yeah,
the inference algorithm would be like, whoa, hold on a second. There's a conflict here.
Exactly. And these constraints, they can even like cascade upward. So if the mode of the list itself depends on the modes of its elements, those constraints are going to like ripple up the chain. It's like a domino effect in a way that ensures this like consistency across the entire structure.
This is making me realize just how interconnected everything is within this system. It's not just about individual variables or functions in isolation. It's really about how all their modes interact and influence each other across like the entire program.
You've hit the nail on the head. That's
yeah.
Exactly it. And a lot of times it actually takes several passes through the code for the algorithm to reach a point where all those constraints are satisfied and everything kind of just clicks into place. But the beauty of it is that once it's done, once it's figured it all out, you are guaranteed to have the most permissive modes possible. So you have this like maximum flexibility, but you're not sacrificing safety.
That's really impressive. But the paper also mentioned some challenges, particularly these things called empty choices in substructural settings. What's that all about?
Yes, empty choices. Those are, they're a bit of a head scratcher, even for seasoned programmers, to be honest. So imagine a function, right? And it's supposed to take a value of a certain mode, but that mode, like, it doesn't actually have any values. It's like saying, you know, give me one of something that doesn't exist. It creates a real logical conundrum.
It sounds like trying to bake a cake with ingredients that you can't even find in the supermarket.
That's a perfect analogy.
Oh.
So to deal with this, inferencepaper.pdf basically says, okay, instead of allowing modes to be empty, we're going to provide this way to more gracefully handle those situations where you're kind of bumping up against the limits of what's logically possible.
So it's like a clever little workaround. Instead of letting those empty choices throw a wrench into the whole system, they've built in a way to like navigate around them gracefully.
Right, exactly. And then there's deep pattern matching. So this takes the concept of pattern matching, which, you know, programmers use all the time to break down data structures and whatnot.
Right.
And it kind of supercharges it so that it can work seamlessly with these substructural types.
Mm.
And to make this all happen, the paper actually draws inspiration from these things called session type languages.
Session type languages.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now I'm getting flashbacks to those late night coding sessions where I swore I'd never, ever delve into the depths of type theory again.
Don't worry, it's not as scary as it sounds, I promise.
Mm-hmm.
So session types, they're actually pretty cool. They're basically used in concurrent programming. And what they do is they ensure that communication between all these different parts of your program happens in this like safe and orderly way.
So it's like a really carefully choreographed dance where every step has to happen in exactly the right order to avoid everyone stepping on each other's toes.
Exactly. Exactly. And inferencepaper.pdf points out how this whole idea of enforcing the right order of operations, or in this case, I guess, the right order of resource usage, can be really, really useful when we're talking about substructural type systems. Because it basically allows us to not only match on the shape of data, you know, like does it have the right fields, is it a list, is it a tree, that kind of thing, but also on the modes of all those components.
So it's like we're not just checking if all the pieces of the puzzle fit together, we're checking if they fit together in a way that respects all these like deeper rules about how resources can be used and reused.
Precisely. It's all about bringing together all these powerful ideas from different areas of computer science to create this system that is both incredibly expressive but also incredibly, incredibly safe.
This is really making me appreciate how interconnected like all these different fields of computer science can be. It's like we're taking all these lessons from concurrency, type theory, logic, kind of swirling them all together to create this really elegant system for managing resources in our programs.
It is fascinating, isn't it? And what's even more exciting is that these ideas, they actually have the potential to go so far beyond just, you know, making our code a bit cleaner or a bit more efficient.
Okay, now you're speaking my language. I mean, we've gone pretty deep on the how of substructural type systems and adjoint logic and all that. But I'm also curious about the why. Like, what's the bigger picture here? Where could this all actually lead us in the future?
That's what gets me really fired up.
Yeah.
Imagine a world where, like, memory leaks are practically extinct, where concurrency bugs become almost impossible to create, and where compilers can optimize our code to a degree that, honestly, we can barely imagine today.
Wow.
Substructural type systems and adjoint logic, they could be the key to unlocking all of that.
So we're talking about, like, a real paradigm shift in how we approach programming, right?
Absolutely.
It wouldn't just be about writing the code itself. It would be about like designing entire systems with these really, really rock solid guarantees about resource usage, all baked in from the very beginning.
Exactly. And you know, what I find particularly intriguing is that agnd24.pdf, it actually hints at some potential applications that extend way beyond just the world of programming languages.
Mm.
So if we can develop these really powerful tools for reasoning about resource usage in our code, the question becomes, could we apply them to other domains as well?
Okay, now you're blowing my mind here. What other kinds of domains are we talking about?
Well, think about it. Any complex system out there where resources are inherently limited, where the interactions are super intricate, and where the stakes of mismanaging those resources are really high.
Right, yeah.
You could be talking about like ecological modeling, where understanding those resource dependencies is absolutely crucial for being able to predict, you know, the impact of environmental changes, or even fields like finance, you know, where we could potentially model the flow of capital and assets in this really rigorous, mathematically sound way. It could lead to more stable and resilient markets.
It's like we're not just talking about writing better software anymore. We're talking about like developing a whole new way of thinking about systems and their limitations in general.
Exactly. And, you know, substructural logic and adjoint logic, they give us this really powerful framework for expressing and reasoning about those limitations in this really, really precise and insightful way.
So for our listeners out there who might be thinking, you know, this is all incredibly cool and everything, but what does it actually mean for me? Like, how is it relevant to my life? What would be like the key takeaway you'd want them to ponder after this deep dive?
That's a great question. I think I'd encourage them to look at the world around them. You know, even the things that seem, I don't know, mundane or everyday, try to look at them through this lens of resource limitations. Whether it's something like the way that traffic flows through a city, the way that energy is distributed in a power grid, or even just, you know, the way that we manage our own time and attention, these ideas of substructurality, they have this surprising relevance.
It's a really good reminder that sometimes it's actually those like most abstract, most theoretical concepts that end up having the most profound impact on our understanding of the world around us.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Wow.
It's all about making those unexpected connections.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you so much for being our guide on this incredible journey through, well, everything we talked about. Substructural type systems, adjoint logic, all that good stuff. It's been a true deep dive.
The pleasure was all mine.
Yeah.
It's always a joy to, you know, explore these fascinating ideas with a fellow enthusiast.